plate a potential nugget.
And what does it mean in terms of leadership, right? Again, how does a leader, again, if you looked at the prototypical leader in emerging markets as compared to the leader in developed economies with deep support infrastructure, what have you observed about what leadership muscles they need to have in addition to what their counterparts in the developed markets have?
So I think there are lots of people who specialize in characterizing the contours and characteristics of leaders, and I'm not one of those experts. But let me provide a more arm's length characterization to some extent.
Sure.
My feeling is that a leader, particularly in the business world, you know, there's a very famous saying attributed to Milton Friedman, the economist from University of Chicago, won the Nobel Prize, saying that the business of business is business, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, if you're a businessman or a businesswoman, the best thing you can do for society is to forget about society and just get on with making money. Because if you do it really well, that's your contribution to society. There are other people who will take care of other things.
Right.
There are doctors who are taking care of the sick. There are teachers who are taking care of kids who need to be educated. There are social service workers who are taking care of those who are down on their luck, and so on and so forth. But what happens when you go to most of the world and none of these conditions are available? Then I think at a very practical level, this admonition from Professor Friedman falls on its face. It cannot be that the business of business is purely business. The business of business, in the interests of business, in the self-interest of business, is to engage in my view, in the partial private provision of so-called public infrastructure. Let me elaborate on that. What I mean by public infrastructure is infrastructure that you put out there, you can use it, but other people can use it also. A road is your canonical example. Public security is your canonical example. You know, the fact that there's security and you feel secure doesn't detract from somebody else's sense of security in the same ambiance, right? Economists say that such things are so-called non-rivalrous. In other words, my using it doesn't diminish its utility to you, or its availability to you. Now, you have to, who is going to provide these public goods, these support services that help creativity, that help entrepreneurship? We could point fingers at the government and bemoan its corruption and its venality and its incompetence and whatever else you want to complain about. And some of it is true, and it depends on obviously place and time and setting. But by and large, it's neither here nor there, is my very practical point and admonition to all of us. What's the point of pointing fingers? Why don't we just get on with it and find the people within the state apparatus who are willing to work on constructive things, are willing to extend a hand to the private sector and to work with the private sector. And I'm convinced that they exist in every single society. It's only a few bad apples that give the public sector a less than glowing reputation in many instances. And work with them to help them to create the conditions to create. And if that means that a private entrepreneur has to contribute to something that the public ends up benefiting from, I think that's just fine. And it's often in their own private interest, because the acid test is, are you better off as an individual, as a private business person doing this? Or are you better off sitting on your hands and saying, that's the task of the government? The latter is almost never true. The former sometimes is.
So when you talk about enlightened self-interest as well, yes, in the book, right, in the context of,
that's right,
you know, I think that's, you take right, the example of Charles Shaw and yeah, the way he shared IP.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that for a minute?
Sure. So Charles Shaw is a colleague, a friend who I met some years ago, and he was a former entrepreneur, actually in the tech industry, from originally Taiwanese, worked in Southern California. And really got fixated on this problem of contaminated milk poisoning in China back about 10 years ago in 2008, and realized that all the solutions the government had put forward, better information, more education, severe punishment, chastising, public shaming, none of it had really worked. The number of people who got to touch milk from the time that it came out from the cow to the time that a child consumed it was far too many to police and too many ways to make mischief. And people were adding these contaminants that made the milk look as though it had a higher protein content, but actually were chemicals that damaged the organs of kids and immune compromised patients. So he decided that he would come up with a technology-based solution to tracking each and every cow, to making sure that the care of the cow was individually customized to the cow. And he had this feeling that his objective was to generate happy cows. And then he had a lot of measurement systems in place to say that happy cows clearly deliver something like, 20% more milk than if you take the same cow and put her in a conventional dairy setting where you don't have all these customized sensors and so on, collecting data and customizing the feed and robots that clean the cow poop away and what have you, and very pleasant cow sheds. If you don't do that, the productivity goes down. Very simple, ultimately an economic argument. And to cut a long story short, the main constraint that emerged to his growth of this successful farm that he created was that dairy farming was never sexy in China, still isn't. And he couldn't find techie people from the big cities to come and work on his techie dairy enterprise, because it was much cooler to go work for Alibaba or Tencent or do WeChat or something like that. Mm-hmm. So his gimmick was, let me just give away the IP. Now, why give away the IP, the intellectual property involved in creating happy cows in a tech-enabled dairy farm? Well, the idea was that somehow if a young person graduating from a reasonable university came and saw only Charles Shaw was the maverick doing this, one could imagine that they would have some trepidation in banking their careers on Shaw's efforts. Whereas if they saw that, oh, look, there's a dozen farms or 20 farms or 50 farms or a mini industry setting that's doing it, maybe my career is not hostage to Charles Shaw and his situation. So essentially by giving away the intellectual property to the horror and chagrin of his financial backers, he was able to begin to attract some tech talent to come into the tech dairy industry in a way that then alleviated to some extent the constraint and he began to grow. So this giving away of IP precisely in order to foster an ecosystem in which talent came in to then help him to grow the core enterprise so that he became a smaller piece of the overall pie, but the pie was immeasurably bigger, is sort of the essence of creating the conditions to create. So that's why I like that example. And you see this everywhere. I spent a lot of time in the city that I was born in Delhi, but also in Bangalore, where I went to high school. And in Bangalore, I do a lot of work with Devi Shetty, the surgeon. And if you think about the story of Devi Shetty, how he's created sort of a cardiac factory of sorts, which I've been chronicling now for, for 14, 15 years. It's really a sequential creating the conditions to create. So his operation is premised on scale, on a lot of patients coming in. But the problem is that the patients will not come into the hospital because they live too far away, they're uneducated, they can't get away from their work, they're physically unable to get there, so on and so forth. So you've got to invest in transportation, in logistics, in medical insurance, in education, in satellite-delivered telemedicine. You've got to create all these conditions. And that's not what you want to do as an entrepreneur. You want to do heart surgery and cardiac care. But to do that, you have to create the enabling conditions before you're allowed to do that. So there are lots of examples in the book like this. But that's why I say create the conditions to create. And it requires that particular mindset to be able to say, it's a mindset change, right? That, of course, my core skill is going to be in developing happy cows for more milk, or in doing cardiac surgery very efficiently and cheaply for poor people. But to be able to do that, I have to have a mindset shift and say it shouldn't be outside the remit of possibility or beneath me to think of ways in which I can either create these conditions myself or catalyze others to do it along with me. And that requires sort of perhaps a more eclectic model of leadership than you would when only specialization was adequate.
I'm reminded of my earlier conversation with Arun Myra, former member of the Planning Commission of India and former chairperson for BCG India. He spoke about the distinction between leadership in an open system versus a closed system.
To a more open world.
In the 90s.
I'm talking early 90s. We are a much more open world. And in this world, we need to partner with or work with organizations who are in other parts of the world. And also we are finding because of, as you said, the world is more dynamic and information technology even then is enabling us to be in communicating with partners outside our boundaries. How to be successful in a more open world?
While Arun makes this point in a different context, the key insight for me here is that at some level, we need to look at the system we are operating in and solve for the system as a whole. Bringing it back to what Tarun says, as an entrepreneur, if I just solve my piece of the puzzle, the jigsaw is not going to complete itself. I need to work on some of the adjacencies as well for my business to flourish. Thank you for listening. For more podcast content curated by theme, please visit playtopotential.com and go to the curated playlist section. To know more about the coaching and transition advisory work I do, please visit transitioninsight.com.